Good morning. Nice to see everyone. Today I'm going to continue my series of talks based on the koans in the Gateless Barrier, which I'm doing in random order. And today I'm going to talk about Case 19, Nanchuan, Ordinary Mind is the Tao. It's on your program. And I'll start just by reading the entire case. Xiaozhou asked Nanchuan, "What is the Tao?" Nanchuan said, "Ordinary mind is the Tao." Xiaozhou asked, "Should I direct myself toward it?" Nanchuan said, "If you try to direct yourself, you betray your own practice." Xiaozhou asked, "How can I know the Tao if I don't direct myself?" Nanchuan said, "The Tao is not subject to knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion, not knowing is blankness. If you truly reach the genuine Tao, you will find it as vast and boundless as outer space. How can this be discussed at the level of affirmation and negation?" With these words, Xiaozhou had sudden realization. So there we go. And I'm going to go through this line by line. Starting at the beginning, Xiaozhou asked Nanchuan, "What is the Tao?" So this encounter takes place in China. It's around the year 800. Xiaozhou is the student here. Nanchuan is the teacher. I'm going to refer to them as the student and the teacher throughout most of this talk, just so it's easier to keep them straight. So the student was 18 years old when he came to the teacher, and people who have studied this situation think that this encounter took place not long after that. And obviously he's a sincere student, and he asks his teacher a very basic question. What is the Tao? So I think we should ask, so we're all on the same page here, what the student means when he refers to the Tao. So Tao, T-A-O, is a word that can have many meanings. Taoism, of course, is one of the major spiritual traditions in China. And it's a tradition that Zen really drew upon. But I don't think this is an explicit reference to the spiritual tradition that is Taoism. Tao is a Chinese word meaning the way, and it occurs in all Chinese religions. And Robert Aitken, who wrote the translation we're using today, says that it began to be used in Buddhism because the early Chinese scholars were translating words from the Sanskrit, and they wanted to use Chinese words that people could easily latch on to. So they used the Tao. The Tao means the way. So that could be the way of practice. The student could be asking, how do we practice? What is the way of the Buddhas and ancestors that brought them to a deep understanding of how things work and what we're supposed to do? We could imagine that the student is asking about the nature of the universe. What is Tao? What is everything? But I think not, because the rest of the conversation indicates that he's really thinking about practice. What way should I follow? What should my practice be like? And that makes perfect sense. He's a young monk. He's come to the monastery. He's burning with an aspiration to know the way. Think of your own aspiration and think of when it's been strongest. Maybe you've been troubled by life's difficulties. Maybe you really understand on a deep level the first noble truth, that there is suffering. Maybe you feel things more strongly, or you seem to feel things more strongly than some of the people around you. Maybe you have a sense of the profound importance of this life. You want to know, what can I do? What should I do? It is such a mystery, this life, and you want an answer from your teacher, and you want it right away. What is the program? I'll do anything. And this is how we may be when we show up. I will climb the mountain. I will sit facing the wall for days and days. I'll sit for years. I am so devoted to this practice. Just show me the program. So that's his question. What do I do? And the teacher responds, ordinary mind is the Tao. And I think maybe he's a little bit disappointed because he's looking for that mountain or that year on the cushion. Ordinary mind, he's probably thinking, that's what I came here to escape. Ordinary mind is trivial, it's bothersome, it's distracting. I don't want ordinary mind. I want profound mind. I want the mind that will lead me forward along this path. And if the student is thinking that ordinary mind is the thing he's here to escape, well, he's both right and wrong. And that's because there's ordinary mind, and then again, there's ordinary mind. There's ordinary mind from the teacher's perspective, and there's ordinary mind from the student's perspective. The perspective of the student, bless his heart, is by definition a self-centered perspective, because that's how we all start out. That's human nature. To him, ordinary mind is all wrapped up with desire, with need, with his own interests. He's been around long enough to see, at least in a superficial way, how the Four Noble Truths work in his life. He knows the second noble truth, that suffering is caused by desire, so he knows that fulfillment of desire is not the way to happiness. He knows that ordinary mind, with its continual rush toward getting things, toward grasping, is the way we're hardwired, and that's wonderful in the sense that it helps us to survive. But it's also a problem because it traps us in a world of perpetual grasping. A world where a desire comes up. We try to fulfill the desire. The desire is not fulfilled, so we're unhappy. Or maybe the desire is fulfilled and we're happy for a little while and then we're afraid of losing what we have. And then a new desire comes up or a new fear comes up. And we're unhappy again. And to the student, that's ordinary mind. And he's burning with an aspiration to escape it. But to the teacher, ordinary mind is something else. Ordinary mind is not bound up with desire and the fulfillment of desire. It's not chattering mind. It's not needful mind. It's the ordinary mind that's left when one has practiced the third noble truth, which is that suffering can be eliminated when we eliminate desire. Ordinary mind is what's left when we've abandoned desire, such as the desire for material comfort, the comfort of the nest, the comfort of our ideas about ourselves, and even the comfort that comes with being on the Buddhist path. Ordinary mind to the teacher is doing the work with no expectation of reward. Ordinary mind is this, just this, nothing extra, no desire. And also, no separation. And this is a really important point. From the student's perspective, there's this great separation that characterizes being alive. There's my busy, grasping, suffering, ordinary mind, and there is, on the other hand, the mind I want to have. There is the Tao, and there is me. I'm not part of the Tao. If only I could get to the Tao. The teacher is being kind but firm here. The student is asking basically, what special practice can I do? And the teacher gives him a frustrating response. There is no special practice. It's about ordinary mind. So what does the student come back with? Should I direct myself toward it? Okay, he wants to know more. He's like, okay, so it's ordinary mind. That's not quite what I was looking for, but I'm willing to accept that. How can I get this ordinary mind? So he's making a little progress. Okay, I can give up my ideas about ordinary mind. But he's still fundamentally coming from the same perspective. He's grasping at practice, and he's still in the world of separation. Should I direct myself toward it? There is me, and there is it. How do I get to it? And the teacher, of course, is going to try another way to say that there is no I and it. I is it. I is it. Not I'm it, but I'm it. Because that's what the student needs to hear. Now, eventually, once the student is able to hear that, the teacher can come back and say, actually, you are it. But this is not the time for that. That will just create confusion right now. We'll return to this at the end when we read Wu Men's verse. What the teacher says is, if you try to direct yourself, you will betray your own practice. Another translation says, if you try for it, you will become separated from it. Basically, he's saying, do not direct yourself toward it. And we know why this is. It's the separation problem. If you direct yourself toward it, again, there is you and there is it, and you are setting up two different things. And these things are not separate, and you can't be truly authentic if you act as if they are separate. In a way, there's no middle ground here. You can't start out saying that you are separate from the Tao, and then you're going to work on it a little bit, and then you'll be a little less separate, and then you'll get to 50% less separate, and that's really good, and then finally you'll get to only 5% separate, and you'll get rid of that 5%, and then you'll be enlightened. That's appealing, but it doesn't work that way. You can only give up the separateness here, now, entirely. And that's why the teacher keeps coming back relentlessly and saying, no, 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 it's not that, it's not that, it's not that either. It's not that even provisionally. Everything you've relied on to this point doesn't work. Just stop. Just stop. And this approach is a little hard. It's a little harsh, I think. You get nothing. If you read the great Zen masters like Dogen, you don't see stuff like, oh, I know this is so hard for you, and I'm sorry. I might say that, but the great Zen masters don't. It's all or nothing. It's just that you have to give up the separation now. That's Zen. Directing yourself toward it is separation. So all of the burning aspiration that the student has about practicing because he knows about suffering, because he wants suffering to end in this moment, he's got to forget that. He's got to forget even the aspiration that got him here. How does he do that? Well, he still doesn't get it in this little story. He's really frustrated now, and he asks, how can I know the Tao if I don't direct myself? So still in his mind, there's that separation. I want to know the Tao. He's unable to change his perspective at this point. He imagines the connection between himself and the Tao, but he can't imagine it in any way except from his own perspective, which is about desire and the fulfillment of desire. I need to know the Tao. He can't get the I out of it. And I think what the student doesn't realize here is that the teacher is, in a way, answering his original question about how do I practice. He's saying, don't direct yourself. That's a sort of a technique. It's the technique of no technique. It's the technique of dropping back, of refusing to seek, refusing to go toward anything, refusing to imagine anything out there that exists that can be approached in any way. It's the technique of dropping all techniques and becoming receptive. Here I am, totally open, totally vulnerable. What do you got? This takes courage. It takes quietness, it takes focus, and it takes courage. So, what does the teacher say in response to how can I know the Tao if I don't direct myself? He says several things, and he is kind, and he's firm, and he's direct. The Tao is not subject to knowing or not knowing. The Tao is not subject to knowing or not knowing. This really goes to the heart of the problem that the student is presenting. When the student asks, how can I know the Tao? The teacher responds, it's not about knowing or not knowing. I reject the premise of your question. I'm sorry, but I can't answer this question coming from your perspective, which is about what you need. You can ask that same question in 1,000 ways. How can I get this thing? And each time I will answer, you must give up the need to get that thing. And that's the third noble truth. Suffering ends when you give up desire. You can only break through now. It's all or nothing. Give up the idea of knowing. Don't direct yourself towards something as if it could be known. Hold that deeply. It's not about knowing. It's not about knowing. It's, well, what is it? What is it? It's nothing you've ever known. You can't answer it. You can only open yourself and wait for an answer. The degree of openness required of the student here is truly extraordinary. And how does one develop that opening? You keep working. You keep working at it. You remember the fourth noble truth, which is the eightfold path. There are eight ways to do this practice. The teacher goes on, knowing is delusion, not knowing is blankness. Knowing is delusion. As has been said many times, if you think you know it, you don't know it. When you finally stop directing yourself toward it, and you see what remains when you take your own need out of it, then you may say, that's it, and you will be absolutely right. And if in the next moment you say, that's still it, now you're absolutely wrong. If you think you know, you don't know it. When you said, that's it, you were in a place that was not about knowing or not knowing. When you said, that's still it, you were in a place of knowing. Not knowing is blankness. There's the not knowing that we sometimes talk about in a positive way, which is the same as not subject to knowing or not knowing. It's just being open. But there's also the not knowing that is simply not even trying. And that's a danger too. The teacher goes on, if you truly reach the genuine Tao, you will find it as vast and boundless as outer space. So the genuine Tao is hard to describe. It has no continuing characteristics. It has no boundaries. Like outer space, it is unimaginably vast. And I think we would do well, each of us, now and then, to contemplate the vastness of the universe, of the tiny place that the earth has in the vastness of the universe, and of the tiny place we have on the earth. That will help us, I think, to take ourselves out of ourselves. If you truly reach the genuine Tao, you will find it as vast and boundless as outer space. This also recalls Sung San's, the way is perfect like vast space, nothing lacking, nothing in excess. Vast space is perfect. There's nothing wrong with space. Can we possibly argue that vast space is defective in some way? No. The way is perfect, as you are. You are part of the way. You are perfect as well. That's the Tao. That's how it is. And then finally the teacher says, he asks, how can this be discussed at the level of affirmation and negation? This is one final appeal to the student. The teacher is saying here, we can't even talk about it at the level of desire and fulfillment of desire, or at the level of separation, not even at the level of yes and no. We've got to give up every discriminative thought. The student's burning aspiration brought him here, but here in this conversation with the teacher, it cannot be about aspiration. And then the last line of the koan, with these words, Xiaozhou had sudden realization. So finally, it works. It works. Is it okay to be a little happy here? Probably not. Not if we're going to be consistent. So the student gains insight. And we might wonder, how does he demonstrate his insight? We don't know. With a smile? With that way of letting one's face just be one's face? With that glow? That absence of concern and trouble? We can imagine that it's playful, whatever it is. We can imagine that the student then went off to work practice and was washing the windows and carried a little playfulness with him. And let's hope the teacher did that too. So there's also a comment to this koan. There wasn't room to put it on the program, but I'll tell you what it is. This was written by Wu Men, who compiled this koan collection. And the comment has two sentences. The first one is, questioned by Xiaozhou, Nanchuan lost no time in showing the smashed tile and the melted ice where no explanation is possible. So he's commending Nanchuan for no delay, for going instantly to the heart of the matter and showing the smashed tile and the melted ice. And I think those are two nice images here of what it was that the student experienced when he gained great insight. One is a smashed tile. When we truly come to the moment, when we drop discriminative thought, when we're dropping our usual way of seeing, the way we've always relied upon our whole lives, it's like a smashed tile. The tile of ego. That sounds a little scary, but it comes with a great freedom. The other image is melted ice. We cease to be rigid. We flow. We flow into any crack or depression that presents itself. It's not in our control. We don't want control. We're like water. The second line of the comment is, though Xiaozhou had realization, he could confirm it only after another 30 years of practice. This is interesting. The student needs another 30 years of practice. Koans in this collection very often end with the student gaining insight, and we tend to assume that's full enlightenment, but that's not always true. It may be a Kensho experience that is quite profound, but it goes away after a while. It goes away because it is so easy to forget that it's not about knowing and not knowing. It's so easy to want to know again. And this is hard to experience for someone who has had Kensho. A lot of patience is required. But it's okay. And remember that Xiaozhou, it took him a while, but he became a great teacher. He appears in case one in the Gateless Barrier. A monk asked Xiaozhou, does the dog have Buddha nature or not? Xiaozhou said, moo. You know that one, right? 30 years is a long time. But moo is deep and wide, as vast as outer space. Time doesn't matter so much. Be patient. Do now. Don't do later. Just do now. Finally, there's a verse by Wu Men, a four-line verse, and it goes like this. Spring comes with flowers, autumn with the moon, summer with breeze, winter with snow. When idle concerns don't hang in your mind, that is your best season. This is funny, I think. Wu Man ends it all with a joke. That is your best season is a bit of a joke. But it starts. Spring comes with flowers, autumn with the moon, summer with breeze, winter with snow. Different times are different. Let them be what they are. Accept them as they come. Don't direct yourself toward them. This is good advice. Then he goes on, when idle concerns don't hang in your mind, so here Wu Men is helping us with our practice. Just remember, don't let idle concerns about how to practice or who to be take over. It's a final encouragement to us. But then, that is your best season. When you can let those idle concerns not hang in your mind, that is your best season. And that's the joke, because this whole thing has been about not trying to know, not directing yourself, not having any preference whatsoever. And it's all about non-separation. And here at the end, Wu Men adopts the language of separation. Your best season. Your best season. This is about separation and preference. He's appealing to the desire of the aspiring student. In the end, we come back to the kind of language that the student was using at the very beginning, before he had his insight. Wu Men is saying, hey, you can get some good stuff from Zen. So I think that's kind of a joke, but that's okay because Zen is a joke. When all is said and done, when we've spent our time on the Zafu, when we've given up our ideas of knowing and not knowing, when we've encountered vast, boundless space, you know what? This world of form and desire is still here, and we can play in it. That's the joke. It's a lot of fun. We can play here in the world of form. But not indiscriminately, I have to add. When I say that we can play in the realm of desire, do not suppose that I mean that we can play there freely, with no thought about other beings, with no thought about what's right or wrong. No, we play with an understanding of the Tao, which is vast like outer space and encompasses all beings. And thus our play respects, honors, and loves those beings, and we care for them. We honor the precepts. The precepts are there, too, in vast space. And so given this joke, I can end this, as Aitken does in his commentary, by asking, what is your best season? When has Zen practice, or whatever practice you've done, been best for you? And how did that happen? And how can you draw upon that to encourage yourself now and be the best practitioner you can be? What will it be like today when you walk out that door into the cold? Will you already be on to the next thing? Or will you be there in the cold? When you walk by the lake, will you see the lake? Will you direct yourself toward it? Or will you let it come to you? Will you let ordinary mind be? And I could go on and on with these kinds of questions, but I don't. I just would like to wish you a very wakeful day and a very wakeful year. So that's what I have to say. And if anyone would like to say something or ask a question, that would be wonderful. And if not, that's okay. I do different kinds of talks, and this kind of talk seems to elicit the fewest questions. Maybe we just want to kind of leave it there. No, here we have something.
There was a nice metaphor in one of Anthony DeMello's stories. He said, after meditation, be it like a person who has just had brain surgery. Move carefully, attentively, be aware of everything. And I like that.
Yeah, that works. That works. Carefully and attentively. Do each thing. Just do this thing. It's pretty simple. It's pretty simple. It's so simple you'd think you could just do it, but You need to work on it. You need to work on it. Do the meditation. Do the meditation. Quiet that mind, that grasping mind, that searching mind, that mind that loves to build thought constructions relentlessly. The more you sit, the less likely that your mind is going to give into that urge, I think. Was there another comment with Jim? Yeah.
Yeah, your talk reminded me of a joke I heard recently about a couple of monks who spent days and days climbing a mountain to learn from a guru, and they finally, or a teacher, and they finally get to the teacher, and they say, "Teacher, teach us the way." And he says, "Go find your own mountain."
Yeah, very good. Very good. It's kind of what's going on here. Yeah. Anyone else? Yes, Joe.
To me, this koan was a really good description of what I deal with on a usual basis in my work, in that we do this technical problem-solving process, and we have to come with an open mind, not have an agenda to drive towards,
mm-hmm.
but we have to solve the problem. We can't just say, "I don't know the answer."
Mm-hmm.
And like, it's we have to keep an open mind to what the possibilities are. We have to let the facts lead us to the answer. We also can't boil the ocean. We have to eventually do something and make a decision. And we can't know everything about this particular thing. We're not going to write a PhD thesis on
mm-hmm.
what we're trying to solve.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, we have to understand it well enough to make a decision, but also know that we don't fully understand it either.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always a balance of how do we find this solution for what we're trying to fix.
Yeah, that's well said. It is a balance. You're talking about solving a problem here in the world of forms, and I'm talking about, you know, this koan is about something different from that, which is really, really kind of letting go in a deep way. So when we're working on a practical problem, there's that balance, and there's right thought, and there's thinking that we bring into it and to keep things in perspective. So the letting go and letting it come to you is an important part of problem solving, but as you say, that needs to be balanced with thought and decision making.
Inquiry, you have to be inquisitive about what's going on too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, inquisitive. Yeah, thank you. Okay, yes.
I was just noticing that I wasn't able to get here on time for Zazen this morning, and there was a real difference between listening to the Dharma talk, having not had that opportunity to just sit and quiet my mind. It was just very different, which is just kind of a nice reminder of how meditation is so important. And it made me think, like, well, what if I did this every day?
Yeah. Well, one way to find out. Yeah. Thank you. Yes, Raymond.
First, I wanted to thank you for the talk. And it reminded me of my my own struggles as the student,
mm-hmm.
something practical that I've been wrestling with a professional relationship with somebody, and this just like hit the nail on the head that I am separate. You know, I want something. I want them to change. I want them to give me what I want, how I want it, when I want it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the right way.
Mm-hmm.
And in reality, first thing is the eyes, and that it just hit me that I am viewing it from my perspective and how we are separate,
mm-hmm.
and how it's not going to work. it also reminds me of how many times I've, you know, universe is funny and it keeps giving me the same problem, I guess, until I learn it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a bad student, but...
I see.
Keep coming.
Yeah, yeah. And, yeah, why are we so hesitant to kind of see it from the other perspective? You know, is it kind of self-protection, protecting our ego? Is it habit energy? Is it just that we're not... It just doesn't occur to us or something. But, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Paul?
Yes, just Joe's comments. I happened to read something just last night, something about engineers. Their problem with engineers is they kind of lose the creativity. They're taught to be very analytic and just drill down to a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of limits their bandwidth for creativity and thinking outside the box. And the article said the solution to that is mindfulness.
Hmm.
So, and it wasn't it. It was like a business type article. So.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of interesting.
Yeah. Excellent. I agree with that solution. All right. Well, shall we turn it over to our Doan here for some announcements?